So this very recent work, so recent, like half an hour ago. Well, I think it's an interesting line of work because it connects things which we have been doing for a very long time with ideas which have been around, especially in the work and the followers of a local here, Raphael Sorkin. So it's trying to sort of combine ideas of processes which we have been working on for about 5 years with ideas of causality. And these are sort of the first steps. It turns out to be much less trivial than one expects to get these ideas going. So since there are, I assume there's people who haven't seen me giving talks before, so I'm starting with something very old. So basically this is analysis of a quantum teleportation protocol. Everybody knows here what this is, I guess. Quantum teleportation, yeah. So the way I prove this, I would prove this is like by using a bunch of lemmas here, which might not look very familiar to you if you look at them like this, but the easiest way to see, except for probably this, which is kind of Troy Chmielkowski, but if you kind of put them in a certain graphical notation, then they look very intuitive. So I'm going to depict linear maps by boxes with an input and an output. I'm going to depict composition of linear maps just by two boxes where I plug the output of one to the input of another. Like a bipartite state, I just depict by such triangle with two outputs. It means a state, two outputs, two things I can act upon. So a linear map is something which takes something in and which takes something out. A state just gives you something. And the dual would be an effect, which just takes something in. And then, like the tensor between two things, I just represent by putting two such boxes side by side. So many people here have seen it's a very simple notation to represent the idea of composing linear maps, tensoring linear maps, and such. And then these four lemmas basically look like this now. They look very simple. Like one of them just means, if I've got an identity, because not just a wire means an identity for me, and I tensor an identity with a linear map, and then I post-compose this with this linear map tensored with the identity, it's the same as this linear map tensored with the identity, identity tensored with this linear map and post-composed. This is like the Troy Chmielkowski idea, that if you've got a bipartite state, you can always write this as, this is going to be the Bell state for me, the Bell state with a linear map acting on one side. You can do this for any bipartite state. So this is a bijective correspondence. And then if you happen to take this linear map, well, you can as well apply the transpose of it at the other side. That's just the same thing, it turns out. And then this is like the funniest one. If I take a Bell state and I tensor it with the identity, and then I post-compose it with the adjoint, like the corresponding bra to the Bell state, tensored with the identity, and I make this configuration, and you actually get an identity. I could have written this straight. So you just get an identity. Now, so this is a bunch of lemmas, and they very easily allow you to prove teleportation as follows. So you start with some unknown state here, and you got a Bell state, and then you apply a certain effect to these two guys. And then the idea with teleportation is that with a certain correction at this side, the whole thing you should reduce to the identity. That's the idea of teleportation. So now we're going to use these lemmas which I had. First of all, we can sort of plug out of this, since it's a bipartite effect, we can just represent it by the Bell effect. And we plug out the linear map, right? And I'm just going to write the adjoint just because it's going to work out nice then. So this is actually means then needs to pick this guy in a certain way to match up with this. Now I can use this thing of throwing this one to the other side, if I just transpose it. Now I'm going to use this little game of that you can switch the order, which was my other lemma. I move all of that stuff up. And now you see this little bit of configuration here, which you could swap as the identity. And here you see that two things, if this guy would be unitary, and here I've got a conjugate and there a transpose, so they're mutually adjoint, so they would vanish, and you get teleportation. So it's based on these simple lemmas here, you get sort of a nice, purely diagrammatic proof of teleportation, where you don't really have to be specific about which linear maps these are. And it's sort of all very smooth. So that kind, that observation motivated us to actually jump into the world of category theory and start some research program which we call categorical quantum mechanics. The idea is like to abstract away from anything in the previous which still has to do anything with Hilbert spaces and linear map and just see at what sort of abstract level can we do this kind of reasoning. Like, can we do this with other mathematical structures than Hilbert spaces and linear maps? Exactly the same thing. So what is the most general abstract level at which you can do that? There's many reasons. Like, some people have the desire to go beyond Hilbert space quantum mechanics, maybe, because that's what you need to do if you want to go to a theory of quantum gravity. Maybe you just want to, you don't really need to carry around all the details of Hilbert space for certain computations. And if you have a much simpler structure in which you can do a bunch of computation, that's a big advantage, especially if you're like a computer scientist and you want to automate things and you want to build things which reason in an automatic way, then you want to work with discrete structures, not with matrices of complex numbers. So there's good, many, many reasons to sort of get rid of the Hilbert space machinery. So we started this categorical quantum mechanics stuff. And the thing is, just by suddenly then jumping in this world of categories, then we saw that lots of the stuff which you assume actually becomes totally trivial. So for example, if you take this expression, this could be for linear maps. I take a linear map and I compose it with another one. I take a linear map, I compose it with another one, and then I tensor them. So this is the same thing in my notation, you see? I take K composed with H, G composed with F, and I tensor them. Now I do the same thing for this expression. I take G tensor K, F tensor H, and then I compose them. And then you see, just by picking the right notation, a non-trivial expression between tensors and linear maps becomes a tautology, which is kind of cool. And this sort of mathematical structure we will use as a basis to represent generalized physical theories. You probably have heard Howard Barham talking here about generalized physical theory or Lucian. There are many people around here who have like schemes for generalized physical theories. So this is a scheme for a generalized physical theory. Main idea is we think of these boxes as processes, some kind of physical processes. And you can compose physical processes. You can put them side by side. And then you sort of, like putting side by side is like composing them in a way that they don't interact. If I put two things side by side, like that, then they are, this is like disconnected composition. Well, if I do this, this is connected. You see, you connect them. So that's sort of the fundamental paradigm. That's sort of the fundamental paradigm in all of this stuff. Are things connected or not? It's very simple. Like basic idea, fundamental idea on which you want to build theories. It seems very trivial and you might not be able to do much, but for example, for those who were yesterday in my talk, it was the same thing. It's just about all about connectedness and disconnectedness. So it's kind of more expressive than you would imagine at first. And so the general idea of these theories. Yeah, I'll go back. Probably better if I say this and then go back. So the idea is that I've got a bunch of systems which I give names, A, B, and C. It doesn't really matter what I mean by a system. It's like sort of treated as a primitive, and later we can discuss what we really mean. But the intuition is you've got quantum systems, you've got maybe classical data, you have whatever you can think of. Algebraic quantum field theory, this would be the region of space-time where you consider your observables. This can be a lot of different stuff, systems. Then you've got processes. Processes are things, if I've got one system or another system, which sort of connect this one system with the other system. For example, this could be like a unitary operation or a measurement or maybe the relation between one region of space-time with another region of space-time in algebraic quantum field theory. Maybe you want to express this as a process between those things. So this is the idea of processes. You have this idea of compound systems. So this is my disconnected composition. I've got system A and I've got system B. And now I want to treat them as two systems, but sort of, I'm going to make an implicit assumption here. I treat, whenever I write these things down, I sort of think of A and B as disconnected. Now, you have to be careful. It doesn't mean that these systems can't be entangled. They can be entangled, but as systems, they're independent. For example, when would a system not be independent? Well, if A and B are the same system. If A is this piece of paper and B is this piece of paper, then they are dependent, because whatever A will, the state of A will be always the state of B, because they're the same thing. So I mean, we're treating two independent entities, but it's perfectly possible that they're in an entangled state or something like that. So it's different. Yeah, it's different. So that's what I mean by independence. And then, like, then I've got another notion, independent decomposition, like here, and this really means this disconnected form of decomposition, you see? This disconnected form. So, for example, if I write down an entangled state, on A tensor B, you see, this would be a state for A tensor B, but this guy is obviously not disconnected. It's not disconnected. While these systems are, their state isn't. So it's not that important. It will become more important later, and you'll see later why I'll emphasize this when we go to the causal structure of these things. So people have all, like, the moment you see such a thing, you already see there is something like causal structure in there, but it's sort of not, like, really clear yet what. There is this idea of, like, separation in some way, just implicitly built in. Now let's go back. Like, basically, you see the word here, symmetric monoidal category. Now, a symmetric monoidal category consists of this data, and essentially this axiom. And this is called bifunctoriality. That's what a symmetric monoidal category is. Usually there are some other rubbish axioms which have to do with bracketing, and it becomes really extremely complicated. But you don't have to care too much about it. So, in fact, and I'll be a little bit more precise about this later, this graphical language turns out to be an equivalent presentation of this mathematical theory. So, and then you don't have to care too much about all these extra axioms which you can fill books with.
So, is this then basically a state that processes an operator or a propagator or something?
What?
When you say system, is it the same?
No, system is more like a type. It's a type of system. Okay. An electron.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, I probably should emphasize a state. I probably didn't emphasize this good enough. So, yeah, so I forgot to mention this. So you got this. It's because I've been telling this story so many times. So this is the system nothing. I is like the tensor unit for systems, which mainly means if I tensor A, if I compose A with I, then I get A. So A stands for nothing. So the state of the system I will think of as something going from I, which I don't write because it's nothing, to something. So I, the system I, is represented by no wire because it's nothing. And then a state of a system would be something from nothing to something. Like, I could write, so this would be a state, say. It's like something without an input but with an output. Right?
So that's a weird state.
That would be the state. That would be a state. So a state is actually somewhere here, rather than here. It's here, but where you've got a special input. It's in the world of linear maps, just to think concrete in quantum mechanics, if I've got a vector, psi, then I can define a linear map, psi, which goes from the complex numbers to a Hilbert space, and which maps the number 1 on psi. And this linear map is uniquely defined by this vector and vice versa. So you can really think of vectors as linear maps themselves. And the same is true for complex numbers. You can think of complex numbers as a linear map from the complex numbers to the complex numbers. The same thing. So basically, even complex numbers I would trade on this level. This just says, this is just the type of the thing, and here this is actually the stuff which is happening. That's probably the right word. This is the stuff which is happening. And then you've got the stuff which is happening, and then things can compose in a certain way.
Inside the processes, or?
I would say the effect of the Hamiltonian would sit there. like the sort of unitary implementation of it, yeah. Yeah. And then basically the time evolution that you apply the Hamiltonian a bit and then you apply it yet another bit, that actually lives here. Where I take one process and I compose it after another. So this will be applying the Hamiltonian a bit and then applying the Hamiltonian a bit later. So right. So this is like a very general framework, and the question is, now, to say something meaningful about quantum mechanics, like before what I did with the quantum teleportation protocol, so how much structure do we need to add to this framework? And basically, so sort of the basic intuition you have there is to have teleportation. Wait, if I've got a compound system, I need something like entanglement. So you better have things which are not always like this. Because you see, this is disconnected. And entanglement really means that there is some connection here. So, and basically, classical to quantum, you would imagine that classical stands to where everything factors, while quantum, it doesn't really factor. This is sort of a naive idea, and only applies, of course, to the pure case. But it will get us far enough, actually, here. And the kind of definition we use, like many people here have seen this many times, but is we say that something is quantum-like if there is a special state, like an entangled state or a Bell state, which satisfies a certain action. You've seen that action before. I sort of showed it before. But now we're going to take this as our fundamental action. Like, it was one of the lemmas which I used to prove teleportation. This will now be our fundamental action. Nothing else. And so you see, I take this guy, I compose it with this one, and I actually use a special notation for it, like a piece of wire, just because it's a very special state. And then you see that this action just means that if I got a bit of wire here, I sort of yank it. It doesn't say anything more really than that. I've got a bit of wire, and I yank it. Now, so that's it. That's our theory. We can yank a bit of wire. Okay, now you can start doing stuff. Like given that in our theory we have, in our language, we have this as an element of our language, we can now take any process. I'm depicting it in an asymmetric manner for the reason I will explain. I take this box, and I can stick this one here. I can stick something like that there, and I define a new thing, which I represent by taking the original box and just rotating it under 80 degrees. It's a definition. Given a box like this, I define a new box, which I represent by 180-degree rotation, just by sticking this thing here and sticking that thing there. So and then we can start proving stuff about this. So here you've got our original box. I make this new thing, and I sort of now represent it by the 180-degree rotation, but I sort of show it as an internal structure. Yeah, I show it as an internal structure, so to clearly show the two at the same time. What do I do now? I'm going to adjoin a bit here and a bit there, and then I can... The first thing I do is now I'm going to hide the internal structure and just consider this guy here. And then the other thing I'm going to do is now take this bit of wire, yank it according to our axiom, take this bit of wire, yank it according to our axiom. You get this. So you see, if I yank this away, I get this internal box with this remaining. Same here. And the idea is that you now get this box and you can slide it across this wire, sort of something. This is something you. This is a proposition which I prove in my formalism. Right? You see, this is something which I prove. What can I do with this? Well, first, I'm going to introduce one additional concept to add expressiveness. I'm going to say whenever I've got a box. So I had already the 180 degree notation. Now I introduce a new notation, the flipping upside down notation, and that will mean, I call this a dagger. It's an additional piece of structure I expect to be my theory, that if I get something like that, I can flip it. You see, we've seen this here. If you've got a state and you flip it, you get an effect. It's the kind of thing you need in quantum mechanics to build an inner product, for example. You take a vector, you flip it, or you take another vector which you flip, and then you get an inner product. So it's something you need. And basically, the moment you've got this guy as part of your language, which you obviously will interpret as the adjoint, you can say that something is unitary just by saying, if I compose it with its adjoint, I get identity. Right? Okay, so we got this language. of these things. And like I said, this actually, if this is a linear map, then this essentially, this was the one related greeting, that's actually essentially Z, is transpose. This would be Z joint, and this would be its conjugate. So this is the adjoint is essentially by definition because I would define it. So the only sort of thing you should verify is that this thing I define by sticking something here and sticking something there, that it's truly the transpose, but that's easy to check. So you get this table now, which gives you the expressiveness of adjoint, conjugation, transposition. Okay, so back to our initial example. So this is clearly an equation or thing, because I can take this guy, slide it up, and then just yank the piece of wire, and I get this. Now, if I take this to be something which is unitary, meaning if I compose it with its adjoint, it's the identity, then I can throw this away. And then you do Alice and Bob thing, and you get quantum teleportation. So that was our goal. We had these lemmas about quantum teleportation. We now did the same thing in a very abstract structure. And you can do more stuff. So this is like an old result. It turns out you can do much, much, much more at such a very abstract level. So that's really cool. That's really cool. And now, so we've done a lot of stuff, but what really makes this, from say, logically very interesting, is the following result. So this is something which I proved that I would show before. So that an equational statement between expressions in, I use this word here, dagger compact. Dagger is about the flipping. Compact are these cups and these cups. That's like a formal name of some sort of category. So a dagger compact symmetric nodal category. So an expression holds in that language, even only if it's derivable in the graphical notation via some automat. That's what I've been using, actually. I never actually told you really what formally the symbolic notation of a dagger compact symmetric nodal category is. I didn't tell you that, but it's not important, because this just says what I've been doing is okay. Because all this graphical thing, game I've been playing is as good as like symbolic maths. So I didn't bother to give you the symbolic maths whatsoever, because it's quite hairy. For example, I showed you that graphically these four boxes gave you a tautology. Symbolically, they don't. So you have to sort of keep them in your theory, and there are much more equations which are trivial. Just to give you one simple example there, if I put three boxes next to each other, then in symbolic, like this, I can just put three boxes next to each other, and it's a clear thing. In symbolic language, I should say whether I actually mean this or whether I mean this. Right? I don't have a choice. I have to say that. That's how maths works. Well, this graphical language doesn't care. And then suddenly you have to think about how all these different things interact, and it becomes a complete mess. And you basically get an infinite set of equations which you can satisfy, and then a very smart guy proved that they are reducible to 5 and stuff like that. But it becomes a whole mess. Now, so this is not that important. This is important. It says that whatever I've been doing graphically is cool. But still you're sort of thinking like, well, yeah, this is very abstract stuff and actually has nothing particular to do with quantum mechanics. Because obviously there is like an incredible amount of these dagger compact symmetric monodal categories around. Like, for example, if you take sets and relations and a Cartesian product, it's one of those. And there's many, 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 many others. So it seems like what I've been doing is not really particularly related to quantum mechanics. And then somebody proved the following highly surprising result, that an equational statement between expressions in dagger compact symmetric monoidal categorical language holds, even only if it's derivable for Hilbert spaces, even only if linear maps, composition thereof, and all that stuff in the concrete Hilbert space case. So although this stuff is really abstract, you can't really prove anything more or less than you can prove in Hilbert spaces, but exactly the same thing. And that's like a very, in logic, this is called the completeness theorem. Like it means like Hilbert space is like a complete model for this theory. Whatever you prove there, you can prove in your abstract theory. So what we've been doing is quantum mechanics on the nose, restricted to a certain fragment of your language. Yeah?
Just a technical question. So in the first theorem, the homotopy is also up to spatial transformations. So it's like if you have a... state and effect bipartite one inside the other, you can take out, so you can move.
You can move things, yeah, one should be very precise in principle about this, and there are different ways to state these results, but it's really whatever you would think is natural, this sliding of these wires and that kind of, and if you've got these cups and these caps, then you can slide.
I mean, even if you create a closed
cavity. Oh, yeah, yeah. So if I've got this.
Yeah.
Okay. At this stage, there are no braids here, so there is no issue of something is in front of the other. Or. So it's in 3D.
So if you have like a bipartite state and a bipartite effect contracting to each other, and another thing like this inside this
contract. Oh, you can put it out. You can put it out.
Take it in the,
yeah, you can put it in the air and put it out. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and this is, yeah, for dagger, so that you can.
This is for this specific, but you're right. Like, if you want to really get the nitty gritty of this, there's a nice survey again by the same guy.
Yeah, yeah, you know, that's why.
He sort of goes in really the nitty gritty of the different categories of what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do.
In this case, it's partial.
Yeah. Okay, so that's really cool, and this thing made my career. otherwise, I wouldn't be here. So this is from a while ago, and it's good. People think this sexy, girl thinks this sexy. Now the X-rated part is coming, of course. So you become like a bit of a rock and roll star. I found it really cool to see my picture under P equals MP, just because of like pulling some wires, which is kind of cool. Right. So a picture is worth 1,000 qubits. How much money would 1,000 qubit quantum computing be worth? So great. Right. Okay, so that's funny things. I found this funny. It came from the same blog post. If any of you discover a caveman drawing looking like this, we have a problem. It's kind of funny. But then ultimately, this is what you're going for. Right. So that's all cool. So this is very dangerous. And now there are some other blog posts on this topic which are completely bad. And so this guy is a very serious guy who wrote this one. He's like a top complexity theory guy. And he writes pictures of a special kind to explain quantum information protocol. This, in his hands, is, in my opinion, extremely insightful and helped me really to get it. So this is kind of the thing which I just showed, and it tells you, get it. And then you go to some other papers, and people also claim to have gotten it, and they say that you can use quantum mechanics to signal, because that's what this picture is clearly telling you, right? Right? That's what this picture is telling you. I've got like A here, I've got future light cone, I've got B, past light cone. I do my yanking thing, and whoa. We don't have to care about light cones anymore. So is this it? Is this it? Obviously, this is not it. This is not what you want to get from this stuff. So, but okay, you sort of, when people say this, sort of, if you say, whatever. Doesn't really matter. So today I'm going to try to do something about this that people can't think this anymore. So it's like, how can you fix this? Now, what is really wrong here? Why is this wrong? Yeah, the thing is, this is post-selected, of course. This is post-selected, and if you use post-selection, you can signal. You can't realize an effect physically, so this is not a physical process, because an effect is not something you can sort of do with certainty. So this would be an ill-founded lesson from that thing. And the main problem is post-selection. So basically what you have to do is, you have to introduce a little bit of classical wire here, which takes your measurement outcome and uses the outcome, the non-deterministic outcome, to pick a particular correction. And then you have a flow of information, but your information flow is perfectly fitted within. It's completely causally sane. Like, that's the kind of thing, how you fix it. Right? So there's technical things. We use these Frobenius algebras to do this, which I talked about yesterday. It's not going to talk about this at all. Right. So Now a disclaimer. So I was just talking about the big success of Dagger Compact categories. Unfortunately, the physical process universe is not a Dagger Compact symmetric monoidal category. So that's a big statement. And why is this? Just for the simple reason that if I take a state and I either dagger it or I transpose it, I get something which is non-physical, which allows me to signal. So these guys are bad. So basically, the whole nice story and our whole nice complexity, completeness result and all that seems to be completely useless if you're going to take causality seriously. Because these things can't live in anything which is sort of a physical theory of processes. And that's really the goal here. We want to think of a framework in which all these arrows are physical processes, and we think of some universe which consists of processes. That's like the goal, like a big theory of this kind. And it just doesn't work with these guys, unfortunately. It doesn't, yeah?
By physical process, you mean a deterministic physical process,
yes,
as opposed to a post-selected
process. Yes, yeah, like a total process. Total process, I would say.
What's the difference between saying total and saying deterministic?
Total, that you consider all the possibilities. With the thing which keeps you respecting causal structure. The thing which forces you to respect causal structure. If you... So, it's, you want to have theory where this is not true. That's the thing. You want to have a theory where this is not true. So, and if you want to have a theory where this is not true, you can't have this. You can't have this. Because this introduces this, and then you're there. That's all you need to do this little thingy. Right. Okay, so causal categories is like the new concept. So the goal is to implement the constraints imposed by relativity at a primal structural level while retaining the full power of the things I've been talking about. And that all these little things, this daggering, still can go through without the bug which I just explained. So that's the program. For example, one thing we would like to show is, without even talking about really what the details of your processes are, that doing something like teleportation really requires this classical thing, otherwise there is no information flow whatsoever. That's a thing I would like to prove. So which is the opposite of what I had before. Before I could show that you could actually signal. Now I want to show that this is totally impossible, like without even having to say what a quantum measurement is or anything like that, just purely because of some very basic, the bare bones of the theory, like from the bare bones of the theory, this should be forbidden. And it should still stay simple. It should still stay simple. So we don't want to have to talk about quantum measurement and stuff like that at that level. So the strategy is going to be, in one way or another, to encode the causal set structure, or something more general, actually, within the category. And this so basically what I'm proposing is like a formal definition of something, which is called a causal category. And we call this car cat with an analogy of car set. So car cat, like in short. Back a little note. So this is not a little note saying that we are not going to follow the categorical logic path. And this is not that important as a part of the story, but it's just why it was so hard to find a solution for us. I'm just going to give an explanation why. Because I know quite a bit of categorical logic, and this always has put us on the wrong path. So what does algebraic logic say? So algebraic logic is like you're thinking about propositions, and then you got a partial order. Whenever you have one proposition from which you can derive another one, and you say A is less or equal than B, and you organize them, and in classical logic, you get a Boolean algebra. And that's like algebraic logic. It's like, goes back to Tarski, and this was the old idea of logic. From A, we can derive B, then we write A is less or equal than B, and the conjunction is then the infimum, and the disjunction is then the supremum, and that's how classical algebraic logic arises. Then, more later, in the 70s, people came up with categorical logic, and say it's not always just interesting to know that you can derive something, but sometimes the way, the proof structure, is itself very interesting too. And so rather than thinking just in terms that A is less or equal than 2B, this is the usual notation for a Homp set in a category. It means all morphisms from A to B, so like all the process from A to B, all these boxes here, say from A to B, they all live in this set. and you're interested in this bigger set of all possible proofs. So this is the set of all proofs from A to B, from which you derive A from B from A. It's like a set. And then the connection, of course, between these two ideas is that A is less or equal to B if this guy is non-empty. There exists a proof. It means this is the only thing you need. There at least has to exist one proof to know that from A you can derive B. And so that's what categorical logic does. And then all these kind of things I've been writing about here, then this you interpret as composition of proofs, meaning I do a proof here and I do a proof there. And so from A and B, I can derive C and D. And this is like first a bit of proof and then another bit of proof. From A, I derive B. From B, I derive C. So from A, I derive C. You see, it's sort of very entailment is sort of nicely represented in this language. So it's sort of, and it's naturally, people have been used, so there is a very close connection now in research between people doing logic in this sense, they call this proof theory usually, and people studying programming languages. Because you can think of a proof as a program where the input predicate is your input data type and the output predicate is your output data type. And you see, there's a complete analogy, which means that people are doing this proof theory mainly in computer science departments because it's like programming language semantics, they call that. This would be a set of, this capital C, it may be not clear, but this is a set of proofs. So I'll just give you some, maybe it's worth to sort of glance through a bit of standard category theory. Just writing this down, this stuff a bit down symbolically. Why we were doing. So usually you say if you've got a category, capital C, right? Then you've got a bunch of objects, like I said, A, B, comma C. This is called object. And then you've got this, what people call home sets. This is, I take two of these objects, A, B, and this is the set of all processes, like I said, of morphisms from A to B. Like an example would be that A, B, C are sets, and these things is just a set of all functions from A to B. Right? And then you've got a way of combining these things. For example, this would then be Cartesian product. And this is just composition of functions. So that's what you have. So that's not more, it's just the symbolic notation for the things I've been talking about. And now, why is this bad? Because this seems to be the natural way to go. Like, this is a partial order, like, say, a causal structure. Why not sort of blow this up? Like, if A is causally related to B, then we stick a whole bunch of processes there. And if A is not causally related to B, no processes. Because you can't go from A to B. Seems like a very simple idea. Like, the obvious thing to do this idea of, like, we go from a partial order to a category where now you got all this process sitting in exactly the same way as this provability idea leads to proofs. It simply doesn't work for the following reason. If I look at this scenario, A and B are not causally connected. So A and B, A is not less or equal than B in the causal order. However, I can do this thing. I can do this thing. You see, there is not an equality saying that it's equal to. I'm not saying what it's equal to, but I can do this thing, of course. I can do this process. I can do this process. And there is an overall process. It exists. Right? I'm not saying what it is, but it does exist. So this thing should not be empty. Because this thing lives in there. I'm not saying what it is, but it lives in there. So that paradigm sort of doesn't work. So basically you have to change the paradigm. I mean, it took a little bit to realize that for us. So that not existence is the key, but information flow. Now, what do I mean by information flow? So exists means that it is not empty. Not exist means it is empty. Now, information flow means connected. No information flow means disconnected. It's not important why I take this particular notation at this stage, but you see, that's going to be the new paradigm. It's not going to be about existence or non-existence. It's going to be if things are causally connected. If things are causally connected, then the process, there will be connected processes. If things are not causally connected, there will be only disconnected processes. Like you see, this What would you expect to get here? Well, whatever you stick in here is going to vanish. And whatever, there's nothing going to remain of this. Because these are now all deterministic processes, right? Like with certainty, whatever this is. This could be, you would think of this, for example, as just trace. You just destroy the thing with certain probability. So this guy would be completely gone. Well, here you would have some kind of state coming out. And that's exactly what I put here. So this is the kind of thing which this should be equal to, right? Okay, so here is our formal definition. It looks very trivial, but it took a while to get there. So I'm going to spend some time on the board explaining this. I'm doing time, it's okay. I can't think of any simpler way of extending the idea of causality as a partial order to something like involving explicitly these processes. So basically what we're talking about is a symmetric partial monoidal category. By partial, I'm going to mean that I'm not always allowed to write this. This is not always allowed. It will only be allowed if these things are really independent. You remember I was sort of hinting at this in the beginning, and we always treated this informally, but now we're going to treat this formally. If I write this, it means A and B are independent. Really independent meaning spatially separated. Same thing if I write then this. This really means independent. So, so I already wrote down what a disconnected morphism is. So we have this partial monoidal category. Now I'm going to ask that there is, it's okay, that this thing, which stands for nothing, is terminal. Terminal is a technical term. Terminal just means that for any other object or system in your category, there is a unique morphism which takes that system to the terminal. Like intuitively, you think of the trace. It's something which sort of, conceptually, I would think it's about just putting this system beyond your event, so it sort of vanishes. It becomes part of the environment. And you do this without any loss of probability. It's really more like, almost like an epistemic thing. It's not part of, you can think of it physically as so it went beyond my event horizon or something like that. It's gone. But it doesn't come with any probabilistic loss. And it's unique. And that's why I'm going to denote this like this. It's like the earth, like it's gone. It's gone. And then you see that indeed in the previous example when I wrote this down, that sort of really this one is gone, and I got some state here. And it turns out because this one is unique, there is only one of this form. That anything which is disconnected must be of this form. Like if I've got something like that. And I know that it's disconnected, then it must be of this form, because there is only one guy of this form, right? So basically, being disconnected is the same thing as saying that it's of this form. And that's basically what I'm writing here, that the tensor between two things exists if and only if these home sets, both of them, only consist of like disconnected stuff. So everything in here and here looks like this. This can vary, this can vary, this can be anything. So that's the definition. The blue stuff is just like not that important technical nonsense to make it work. But it's not that important. So just some stuff to make it all coherent and that this actually behaves really like a monoidal category. So the main philosophy is you take this idea of you can everything compose, and then you're going to restrict your composition, and you're only allowed to compose things which are independent, but independent with respect to a causal structure. Well, I don't give a causal structure here. It's like encoded within it, right? And some interesting things we're going to see there. Some not surprising. Like your first intuition would probably be like that this is sort of equivalent to taking a causal structure. And then, for example, sticking processes there. Whenever there is a causal connection, you stick processes which are non-disconnected, and otherwise you stick stuff like this. If they're separate, you stick stuff like this. they're non-separate, you take full-blown morph. That's like the intuition you would have. It doesn't seem to work physically like that. But I'm going to give you an example. So you start with a post-settled causal structure, like something Raphael would give you. And then you take a process category, like the stuff I've been... like I'm writing CPMC here. It's not that important, but some people know what I mean by this. It mainly, the reason I'm doing this is because this is a particular structure which guarantees you the existence of something like this, traces. It's not important, just it's some kind of category like I've been describing where for some reason or another stuff like this exists. It's not important what exactly this is. And then you define, basically, this is like a little bit technical, but so you take your objects to be whatever objects you find in the process category paired with region of space-time. So an object in this new category will exist of one of the systems, A and B and C, like I've been describing before, together with some bit of space-time. Not necessarily a point, because I need to be able to compose. Sometimes, so if this, for example, would be a space-time structure, take something like this, I don't know, then I need to be able to write about A tensor B if they're separate. So I also need to be able to compose the bits of space-time, so I'm going to talk about regions rather than points. And these regions, I will only be allowed to compose if they sort of form space-like slices. Because I don't want to compose this guy with this guy. So basically, my system's going to be like, it's very similar to the ideas which are now in Lucian's recent paper, that you look at the space-like slices and you look at the subregions. So this is what I mean by R of P. It's not subsets of your space-time structure, but like slices in it, space-like slices. So I take a space, yeah?
When you said in the last slide that A tensor B exists, I just want to make sure I understand that. So you're thinking of this sort of tensor product as not you know, these two systems can exist, but rather these are independent degrees
yeah.
of freedom.
This is independent stuff which I can compose.
Independence of...
Like you would think, space-time, this will be like this joint union of regions, of space-like separated regions. Like if in a sort of algebraic quantum field theory paradigm, you would take some region of space where you got sort of star algebra, and you got a separate region of space-time, and then you would sort of tensor them. That's an independent tensor with their star algebras, which are sort of the meat of algebraic quantum field theory.
And A and B can also be independent if they're time-like separated, as long as they're actually something in between that cuts one off from the other.
Right. So, but you wouldn't have like a causal thing then, right? Yeah.
And so, also in particular, if the two intersect, you can't tensor them.
You can't tensor them, with the extreme case that the two are the same. So, A tensor A will not exist here, for example. But of course, you will always. The thing is, we're dealing with mathematical structure, so you typically prove if A tensor A exists, then your thing is trivial. So. That's the kind of stuff you will outprove stuff like that, like collapse results. Like when certain things are true, then your theory is rubbish. You can always ask this, but it's not going to give you anything interesting. Right. So basically, here, this is like a construction given processes and space-time regions. So I don't care about this. This has to do with that the unit, of course, is going to be a little bit special in the way you have to construct things. But basically, I take like a region of space-time of... which is like a spatial slice. I can put a system on it. If I will have two separate regions, then I will take the tensor of the two systems in my process category. I will take the union of these regions. And so actually, that's what I think I write down. So I got a notion of tensor there, which like is union on the regions and comes from my underlying category, the tensor on the processes. Right? And then I do the obvious thing. Like, don't care about this. This has something to do with normalization, but it's not important. Well, it's important, but it's not essential to understand the story. You take the full-blown homsets if things are causally related, and you only take the disconnected stuff if they're not causally related. So that's how you construct such a thing. That's how you would construct such a thing. It's like a very straightforward construction, so you could ask, why not just work with this kind of stuff rather than having to have like an independent structure like this. And the reason is that this actually doesn't work. I'll give you an example. This is like this is actually a counterexample almost to algebraic quantum field theory, because they sort of follow the spirit. They take space-time structure and they fill the space in with C-star algebras. And there's something, and I've always found that there was something weird about that. But this is the problem with that. If I've got region A, and I've got B, and I suppose that there's space like separated, and then I've got a B prime, and B is connected to B prime, and then I've got again a C, which is far away, then with this kind of construction, the processes between these two would be everything from A tensor B to B accent tensor C within the given category. Of course, this is not true, because this would include the process where here, I, for example, throw away B. I don't use any information from B. I stick in some random state in B prime, and then I put the identity between A and C, while A and C are like spatially discrete. So this thing is obviously not allowed. But this would follow from a construction of this kind, which is very similar to what you're doing in algebraic quantum field theory. So the thing, it has to do with like decomposability, that some parts may actually be spatially corrected and other parts of your regions might not. So what do you do? It becomes very messy and complicated, you see it. And you want to avoid having to think about it. So this is the solution to your problems. You just don't, this is sort of all built in and you don't have to specify. You just don't care, it's axiomatic. So trying to build, so what the message here is trying to build something which has both like processes and causal structure from a theory of processes and a theory of causal structure is a bad idea. You don't try to build it, you just axiomatize it like this, and then you avoid all the trouble. It's gonna, whatever is out there is going to satisfy this. Okay? And it's sort of nice that it's not just the thing which arises from combining a causal structure and a process. It's something more general. It sort of accommodates for a lot more, and that's sort of what's nice about it. Because we were actually worried that initially we thought that all this stuff would probably arise in this manner one way or another. Not at all. Not at all. Which is kind of cute. Okay, 5 minutes left. So what you can do, of course, is given any of these structures, you can basically derive a causal structure from it. Before, very simple, you just say, it doesn't even have to be a partial order. So you could have actually things like loops in it. You could. And so basically you get some graph where G are just the nodes, the objects, and then there is an edge between the graph if this guy is connected. So you can actually build a directed graph like that. Example was the guy I started with in my previous example. That's something. If I would take the previous example, what I would get out is exactly the causal order I started with. Another example here, see, it's something with a loop. Very simple thingy. Just like a simple loop, and then you freely add a unit, and this is like a space-time. Very weird one. Like, connected in this sense, not connected in the sense, connected in the sense of not like this. That there is one guy in there which doesn't look like this. That's connected. So this is disconnected. So it's really topological, connected, disconnected. All what this structure talks about here is connected, disconnected, topologically. It's nothing else. So. Okay, so I'll quick. So there is a notion of Galileian causal sets, and then basically this boils down in this theory that all directed, that for a directed causal thing for which every asymmetric subrelation of a tensor is transitive, then it actually corresponds to what you could call a Galilean spacetime. It's not that important. But, well, it's just a way that you can embed these concepts. Right. Okay. Now to come back to our initial thing, I said, what are the interesting cases of this? The idea was like to get this process theory and this causal structure all nicely together, in the hope that we could recover all this nice reasoning with these daggers and these compact structures. However, compact objects, which just means that you have one object on which you have a cup and a cap, in carcats have only one state, and morphisms between these are disconnected. Which basically means you can't really have them. They're not interesting. In a causal category with a dagger, objects have one state. It's again, bad, right? So basically, that was the X-ray part. right, so but it's not a problem. It's not a problem. So now the next thing is, I already showed how you can get causal structure out of these things. Now we want to do the sort of natural other bit to get process structure out of it. So basically, what we're going to define a process projector for such a target to be a faithful symmetric Noether functor. Well, let me explain. Faithful just means that it preserves that two things are equal in the range if they are equal in the argument. It's like injective on morphism sets. It's injective on processes. Not on objects, on processes. That's what faithful means. Monoidal means it preserves the tensor whenever it exists. Because the tensor doesn't always exist. And we're going to ask just AI, because I is such a very special thing. We're going to basically ask that the only thing which is mapped on I is I. Sort of natural because of this disconnectedness, which is the fundamental. I defines this connection, disconnectedness. So it's sort of the key part of the structure. And now the main idea what we want to do is basically I want to pick a protocol like my teleportation and put it in space-time. That's the whole goal of what is, this has been. And we define a process embedding, because it's the key thing we want to do, as, again, a technical thing, is any partial section. I don't know whether you know what a section is, but for a map, if you got a map F, then something is a section if you got this relation, that if you compose it, precompose it with it, you get identity. But we are now asked these sections to be partial, because you're not interested in embedding your whole process category necessarily, but maybe just like a teleportation protocol or something like that. So you take the teleportation protocol, and then you take the section map, you put it in space-time, and then there is this thing which actually traces you back, which actually, what this thing does, essentially, it forgets the causal structure. It sort of takes the process structure out of your universe. It forgets the causal structure, and you ask for this equation to be set. It's sort of natural that it just means if I take the process component out, the causal component out, and then I embed again, then obviously on the process it should maintain the identity of the process. So what I start from, if I go back, it should be the same thing. It's just maintaining the, it's sort of very, very natural implementation of the idea we extract the process structure. It's sort of the simplest thing you can do. It really couldn't be anything else. And you can easily show that this guy preserves normalization. It only embeds normalized processes. And both preserve connectedness and disconnectedness, which is like the key fundamental thing of the structure. Now I'm going to prove my main result. The teleportation requires classical communication from this structure. So this is what I call a teleportation configuration. I'm not going to tell you what these guys are. It doesn't really matter. It has this picture. There's stuff here, there's stuff there, there's stuff there, there's stuff there. This is what I call... Oh, okay, why did he go? This is what I call teleportation minus classical communication. Same thing. Same thing, but the wire is gone. Same thing, but the wire is gone. Huh? And now my theorem is, for an N-containing causal category, I'll say what this means, this guy is always disconnected. So that was actually my goal. I wanted to prove this, that such a thing is always disconnected. So such a thing is equal to this, always. That's what I wanted to prove. Okay, like by N containing, what I mean by N containing will be clear in my first part of the proof. This, it means I've got something like this in my space-time, sort of the obvious. And the idea is simple, what I'm going to do. I'm going to take this guy, and I'm going to just make sure that A and B are far. I'm just going to embed this. So here I've got this is my definition of my teleportation. I can implement this in many different ways in space-time. I'm going to pick a certain embedding, and I'm going to pick an embedding where this guy is far from this guy. And then, just very simple, by all the maths we have, so since this goes here, the image of this there must be disconnected, because these are far apart. And then by this relation, that f after g is an identity, the thing I start with has to be disconnected. Right? And then whatever other embedding I'm going to do of this guy also has to be disconnected. So this thing is just disconnected. And that's it. Right. Okay, it's time, so I'll stop. I'll just put this on for one guy in the audience. Okay, thank you.
Questions? Maybe I'll start. The place where I was a bit unclear was A and B start out as types. But then, ultimately, you start thinking about them as embeddable within space-time.
Yeah, it's more like events in space-time, which to which you could associate a certain system. It's very close to intuition, I would say, the physical intuition of algebraic quantum field theory. If you think of these regions in space-time with their properties, which are now represented by this star algebra, but without having it to do it, it's very, very akin to this intuition, I would think. But yeah, it's like that's why I used this example in the beginning. But ultimately, you might want to think of this as outside of like something concrete as like a space-time geometry. This could be like somewhere more abstract where you do have certain causal relations and other not, but maybe you don't want to think too much about geometry necessarily a priori. I don't know. Like if I see what I don't know anything about quantum gravity, but if I see what people do, they sort of do crazy stuff. And you start with very primitive discrete ideas sometimes if you really believe that you should start somewhere finitely. And then this is a very general structure which would accommodate this. Yeah. I sort of had a slide, but I'm not going to show this.
I have a second question. You said at one point that you know the logical approach wasn't appropriate for describing processes. And it seemed to me that if instead of that you could imagine a categorical framework that would describe not processes, but rather reasoning about processes. And that you know that should have a logical structure. And there might be some relationship between your category of the processes.
I don't think that the statement that the logical approach is not appropriate is the right one. It's like the specific categorical logical approach, but I don't think that this is less logical. It just makes this distinction between the existence of a process and the information which a process carries through. Like in categorical logic, this such a thing, categorical logic, is as good of a proof as anything else. It's like a super proof because you don't use your assumption. So as a proof of B to A, it's like a really good thing because you don't use your assumption. You don't even need your assumption. As a physical process, it's totally useless because you don't get, as a communication process, it's completely useless because you lose everything about A. So it's this kind, I think it gives more an information tweak on logic, I would say. It's more logic of information flow than logic of what, yeah. In a way, I would say that the categorical logic idea is still too static in a way. And this is sort of an enrichment of that idea, I would say. Rather than saying that the other one was wrong. It was still a bit too naive, in a way. Well, you want to consider both ideas. Like, there is a proof, there is no proof, and there is a proof which uses your input. These are different concepts.
So, can I think of this in terms of sources, sinks, and flows of information?
I would think so, yeah. So this would be like a sink, this is a source. Yeah, exactly.
Is it connected with study parallel computing and distributed computing?
What?
Is this connected with distributed or parallel computing?
People use lots of categorical semantics there, like process concurrency theory, process semantics. It's similar mathematical structures. Definitely, although this thing I've very rarely seen there in the categorical language. I think that's kind of new. Although they use traces, but they usually use traces for feedback loops. So like the trace of throwing everything away, that's something which they usually, I don't know, you don't. Turns out that like the big father of this area, concurrency, died like last week or something, Robin Milner, who brought all this category theory in there. But,
So I did not understand everything, so maybe you could answer a general question. So are you trying to take this general picture of these monomial categories and impose a given causal structure on a given space-time, or are you trying to go
It's the idea that this structure of a monomial category can also encode causality.
Okay, so you're trying to go the other way. You impose a reasonable set of assumptions on.
I tweak the definition, like I make it a little bit richer by taking the tensor partial, and this partiality encodes an idea, the idea that things are really separated.
So you get, is it, the idea then is you can get a causal structure coming out of that?
A causal structure falls out of that. Then a causal structure comes out of that. So it encodes a causal structure. So intuitively, the way we have been reasoning about it, these things was always like that, but we never made it formal. Intuitively, when I wrote down this teleportation protocol, it was sort of there. The idea is sort of there, but we never made it formal. And this is sort of, you want this. That it should come out of the theory. It's such a simple, basic fact that.
So are you also formalizing the relationship between causality and classicality?
This is basically things which are, I don't know. I think we took this actually, we were looking for a reference this afternoon, and we just took this out of a book of Wayne Wirvold, I think. But it's sort of a concept, like a Galilean causal order. So, and this basically translates to a certain structure on your tensor. So if that's what you mean, classicality.
Maybe you have a requirement for disconnectedness.
Right. Ah, okay, in that sense.
And classical condensation. Right.
Yeah,
so I'm wondering whether this notion of having a source, sink and source, is that source, I can view that as a decoherence event.
Right. Okay. No. You're sure that's the big goal of all of this. That's the big goal of all of this. We haven't done much yet, but there is some older work which I did, which relates this dagger structure and to this idea of like this. This sense you're talking about, and this is like basically the actions that are done. And when I introduced this, the idea was like there is, some people know about this, some construction of a category of mixed states, and this was an axiomatization of it. But this, like on the nose, for example, tells you that, like, that something is normalized, meaning if you throw it in the environment, you get the environment itself, even only if there is a special relation between the dagger and the identity, which you mean it's an isometry, which is the kind of thing you sort of want. And if this is a state, it means the state is normalized. If it's in the product, it's the identity. So it sort of connects this dagger structure and this causal structure up. But that's the kind of thing you want to show, how these things now start to interact, certain process structure with certain causal structure. But we haven't done anything there. It's really, I'm serious, this is like, from a few, we started this a few weeks ago, but we only got some parts of it right half an hour ago.
Which paper is, which of the various other papers is that one?
So the thing is the purification one, because the purification one, because I wrote down, I didn't write this down, but another action here is purification action. It basically says that all mixed operations of your theory can be purified into these guys, which then satisfy this action. That's sort of.
But in fact, the paper also contains a discussion of causality. Definition of causal theories, which is basically that instead of saying that a causal theory is a category, you say that the physical transformations are collections of morphisms, so without outcomes. So there is a notion of deterministic transformation, the sum of our outcomes, and the definition of causal theory in that physical probabilistic framework is that there is a unique deterministic way of destroying the system. Which is the terminality of the object I.
Yes, right.
So we didn't separate, we didn't introduce this notion of partial.
Right.
And in an alternative way, we define the collections of morphisms as physical operations.
Right,
so
okay.
The idea that a device gives an outcome, and associated with this outcome, there is some morphism in the
collection. Ah, okay, I see, right.
So it's,
right.
It's a kind of alternative way.
Right, right, I see. Yeah.
And then just maybe you have a lot of slides about quantum gravity.
No.
What is the presentation?
Oh, no, but it was just, I was drunk. I think it was last night I was drunk. Like, no, it's just the idea which I was sort of hinting at. This idea of connectedness could really be a fundamental principle, and then something silly like I was. It's just because I talked about this yesterday. You could think, for example, these GHZ and W modes as fundamental modes of interaction. The thing is that there are a bunch of guys, like including Duff, who do string theory, who have been sort of looking at small black holes, and then they find this connection with GHZ and W, sort of generating things. So if these guys say they're doing quantum gravity, I can say that too. Yeah, you might maybe want to vary this connectedness in a more logical way, like which would then be sort of quantizing space-time, which is the standard methods to do that, like varying a structure. Some people use a topos for that, by the way. So it's...
So when you started presenting this, the CoCats, you mentioned that you could just take any partial order and use that as your causal structure. So is there something like, does there exist a process which will give you any causal structure?
Well, there are always trivial ways to do it, but I think if you, I think that this, that was my main point. I don't think that this constructive way really works. Where is this example? Like what I was trying to do here, I don't think it really works for the counter example I gave here. It just doesn't make sense that you would just, well, there's probably a way to make it work, but it's just horrible and hairy. And the idea is like if you work with regions, that it might be that part of the region is causally related to another part, but then there is stuff sticking out which is not. And so it's very hard to define what actually will be going between. That becomes like real physics, if you see what I mean, like dark, dirty physics, and that's what you really want to avoid here. And by just taking the thing as an axiomatic given, you avoid all this trouble. So it's just much simpler like this. In a way, it's a lot more complicated, I would say, than the plain definition of a monoidal category. It puts something in which sort of you feel had to be there from the start anyway. That's sort of how I feel about it.
I'm not sure I actually understand your definitions here. I don't know if you could explain them more. The point three.
This one.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one really means. This one really means that everything from A to B must be of this form. That's really what it means. Nothing else, because you, like, this is my notation for this thing, and here I just take the whole onset of states, which is whatever can be here, and then I just plug them together. And I say whatever goes from A to B decomposes like this. That's all I say. So it's a lot of symbols, but it's actually a very simple idea. It's a very basic idea, just this. So if I would have a day extra, I would probably have written it purely like this, but I just didn't get there. Because you can write this down, probably these definitions, just purely graphically, like just saying this is equal to that. And then it's sort of very obvious, and then it becomes very simple. And I could say that this one, I actually should have put that picture there. But it's a very simple idea.
But is there also going to be some restriction on the kinds of morphisms between the pair AB and the pair AB when they're causally disconnected in this?
What, AB?
Yeah, if I look at a morphism between A tensor B and A tensor B.
Yeah.
Because A tensor B exists, they're causally disconnected. So I'd expect that there's no way I could interact them together in any interesting way. So all those morphisms should factor.
You could actually imagine that two things are spatially separate, like very far in the past, and then very, very far in the future, two things are spatially separate, so they can perfectly actually even exchange information, like swap. They could even swap if they're far enough in time. So there's no reason to think why they would be disconnected. Just a swap would do it. You just wait long enough that you can do it. It's subtle. You have to. This took like months to sort of come up with this simple definition because we went so wrong many places. It's easy when you see it, but like it was very hairy to get to. So.
Any more questions? All right. Let's thank Bob again.
Okay.